Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
This is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by three historians to talk about Growing Up America, Youth and Politics Since 1945. I'm joined by Susan Eckelman Bergel, Sarah Fieldston, and Paul Renfro, who wrote this really fascinating edited volume about the United States growing up in the post-war period and our understandings of youth and adults during that period as well. But I'm going to let them tell us all about that today as we talk about Growing Up America, which was published in 2019 by the University of Georgia Press. Right now, I'd like to welcome Susan, Sarah, and Paul to the New Books Network and ask them each to tell us a little bit about themselves and how they came to this really interesting project. I think I'm starting with Sarah.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sarah Fieldston. I teach at Seton Hall University in South Orange, New Jersey. I am the author of Raising the World, Child Welfare in the American Century, which came out in 2015, and is a book that explores American efforts to help children overseas and at the same time spread the American way of life around the world during the Cold War era.
Thank you for the opportunity to let us speak about a book and share our insights into this topic. My name is Susan Eckelman Bergel. I'm an associate professor of history and the director of Africana Studies at the University of Tennessee in Chattanooga. And I'm completing a book-length manuscript provisionally titled "Freedom's Little Lights: Children and Teenagers in the United States and Abroad During the Civil Rights Era."
And I'm Paul Renfro. I am an assistant professor of history at Florida State University and the author of Stranger Danger, Family Values, Childhood, and the American Carceral State, which was published last year in 2020 by Oxford University Press. And I came to this project, actually, Susan and I kind of were first discussing the idea of an edited collection after we had served on a panel together at the Southern Historical Association Conference in Atlanta in 2014, I believe. And shortly thereafter, Sarah came on board. You know, she immediately expressed interest in the project, and we all kind of recognized that there was a gap in the literature on childhood and the recent political history of the U.S. So this is more or less what kind of propelled us to this project.
And go ahead.
So I was just going to say, the history of childhood is really kind of a burgeoning field. I'd say over the past 15 to 20 years, there's been just this outpouring of scholarship on the history of childhood. But I mean, I think one of the things that the three of us noticed was that a lot of that work was not really exploring politics. It was not really political. And I mean, on the one hand, that makes sense, right? Because when you think of children and when you think of childhood, right? I mean, childhood is normally thought of as apolitical, right? Children can't vote, right? They can't participate in formal politics. You know, that there's this notion of childhood innocence. But in many ways, precisely because childhood is cast as apolitical, images of children are regularly marshaled by people of all political stripes from across the political spectrum. And even though children cannot participate in politics in a formal way, children themselves were political actors in all sorts of other ways. And so I think, you know, all of us, you know, kind of in discussing what we saw as kind of a gap in the literature, we thought it would be really fascinating to bring together new scholarship that explores the kind of nexus of children in politics. And then in many ways broadens our definition of, you know, what politics can look like.
And this is what I found really interesting also in terms of the book itself. In the idea of the innocence of childhood and the apolitical nature, as you all talk about it in the introduction, and the fact that children themselves are used in politics, are regularly referenced in politics, but that, again, they are non-voters, and so other people need to represent them. And you also sort of sectionalize the book itself into different discussions of childhood and children. But I just wanted to ask you also, because you're threading together two strands, the United States as a country no longer being a child, and also the idea of how children are thought of and the notion of childhood. Can you talk about those different components as the framework and also the substance of the book?
I can start. I think it was important for us to integrate children's voices as they oftentimes redefine politics. Children as actors in their own right deliver different ways of for us to think about politics, oftentimes against progressive formulations and against adult prescriptions of competency. So it was important for us to think through American politics through the lens of children's voices themselves.
And I think, you know, one of the things that we're trying to do here is to kind of weave together children as symbols, but also children as, like, you know, really flesh and blood people, right, who are doing different things. You know, I think a lot of works either kind of look at children merely as symbols. And I mean, that work is very fascinating, right? I mean, looking at children as symbols, it's important work. But then there's other work that kind of explores the lived realities of children. And part of what we wanted to do was kind of weave those two stories together, right? To kind of explore, you know, how children are being kind of marshaled as symbols in political life. But then also, you know, what the experiences were like for all different kinds of children who are growing up during this era. And to kind of go back to your question, I mean, this is really the story of kind of the baby boomers coming of age. You know, we start off right after World War II, and the volume goes through the late 20th century. So we actually have the baby boomers and their experiences during the height of the early Cold War, during the 1960s and all of the rights revolutions, during the kind of more conservative turn toward the end of the 20th century. And so they're actually, you know, our protagonists are kind of, you know, they're children. And then, you know, by the latter chapters, they're actually the parents, right? And there's this new generation of children. And so, you know, in many ways, it's a story about children growing up. It's also a story, of course, about the United States growing up, you know, with kind of in quotes, but the kind of the evolution of American political life during that time period.
Yeah, and in many ways, I think we wanted to explore the idea of growing up and maturity and innocence in this kind of political framework. And I think kind of examining the idea of neoliberalism as not necessarily this kind of endpoint, but a point where we concluded the volume, more or less, and how that kind of political formation is so premised on the individual and the family. And so it's, I think, interesting to kind of conceive of politics in these kind of personal terms, as many of the groups and kind of movements that we're talking about did, but also the ways in which those ideas or that kind of conception was maybe bastardized or manipulated and used in order to further policy goals that serve to kind of foreclose solidarity or foreclose, you know, collective action, these sorts of things. So, you know, and all of this is kind of very, I don't know, it's all kind of conceptual and, you know, it's not necessarily fully formed, and it's really difficult to kind of make these sweeping claims about, you know, millions of people, hundreds of millions of people in this, across this broad expanse and many, many years. But it's a project that we were really interested to kind of take on and, you know, encourage other people to think about.
And in some ways, it's also very concrete because the children's voices oftentimes very much contest and object to the very layers that adults have imposed. And that becomes evident during the Vietnam War. It becomes very evident in Sarah's chapter, I think, and you can share a little bit more about that, where adults have ideas about the roles that young people play and they contest that. And that was very valuable. And in the process, I think we've discovered that if we place children at the center of the stories, then the story doesn't hold quite as neatly together anymore either. It tells us something very different about how we narrate, how the United States itself as a nation narrates progress, change. Young people are really at the center of dislodging that narrative, ideas. A chapter I helped edit in the section that I focused on, Andre Wan's piece, really shows sort of how young people, high schoolers in particular, are at the center of challenging the model minority, something that's been so exploited and operationalized, and to the disservice, not only the community that was at the center of that narrative, but also in the context of communities of color across the board.
And I wanted to ask you, as we sort of dive into this discussion of, as you say, placing children at the center of the narrative and how the narratives then get dislodged a bit, or perhaps they don't hold together, you break up the volume into three sections, and that they are historical contexts. And so there's the Cold War and the sort of rights revolution, and then the sort of the neoliberal as well as voices that hadn't been heard of from as much in the final section. And I just wanted to ask about how you structured this book. Obviously, you are historians, and so it's following a historical trajectory, but also, you know, how you parsed out these pieces in each particular section, and how you came to thinking about, like, children during the Cold War, and how that was a unique experience, and how they were used, and how they adjusted to that time.
Yeah, I mean, so I guess each of us kind of came to this project with our own kind of area of expertise, which is kind of what led us to this, to the way that we divided up the manuscript. With my first book, I had done a lot of work thinking about children during the early Cold War era. Susan focusing on the kind of mid-century rights revolutions of the 1960s, and then Paul thinking about the kind of conservative turn later in the 20th century. And so each kind of bringing our own interests, but also I think kind of three topics that are also kind of hot topics that a lot of, you know, we all felt there was kind of a lot of like really interesting scholarship taking place around these three eras/themes. And it also happened to work out nicely that, you know, they do kind of, you know, it is also chronological progress, right? So as historians, thinking about change over time is always very important. So so that's kind of where the conceptual idea for the book came from. I remember we were on a call with each other when we kind of realized that like this was going to work out really nicely, actually. And then we kind of, reached out to scholars who we knew were kind of working on topics related to these three themes.
Yeah, it was actually a really organic process. We had several calls for chapters. In the initial call, many of these contributors had submitted their work and we were engaged. And as Sarah pointed out, it kind of built on our own expertise, and that's determined the organization of the book. And then we did want to highlight different areas as well. So we did have a second call because we wanted to make sure that areas that were not yet represented would be.
Yeah. And, you know, just speaking about my section, there had been, I guess, quite a lot of conversation in the historical profession, you know, since the early 2000s about the so-called rise of the right. And so, historians have begun, I think, to kind of push against that interpretation. And that's something that I really wanted to explore in that section. You know, this is, as we've discussed, a story of change, but in many ways, it's also one of continuity, or at least one of kind of symmetry on both sides of the political spectrum, if you want to conceive of it in that way. And I don't think that people have really considered how children fit into that formation, or, I mean, people are beginning to, but, you know, as more folks are talking about reproductive politics, you know, I'm thinking of Laura Briggs's work, for instance, you know, I think that that helps to kind of maybe reconfigure the ways in which people are conceiving of the political moments in which I think we still are living. Really from the 70s on. So, you know, age of fracture, neoliberalism, what have you. I think children and the ways in which children's images are operationalized can tell us a lot about that political moment.
And what surprised me about the contributions in the section on mid-century revolutions was the opportunity to really rethink what we know about the social movements, whether it pertains to the periodization of the Vietnam War or the movement for disability rights, and who's really actually at the center of those conversations and how those conversations evolved, and also the limits of those conversations. I think the contributions in the section I was mainly responsible for was really striking. But also to think about politics differently. I think the section on social revolutions, we see, we tend to gravitate toward the marches. And what that section provided was an opportunity to think about politics and the way we define it in general. And by thinking about correspondence, so the direct relationship between public officials and young people, and how coming of age material I manifest in that form. Science fairs, thinking about young women in science, that's a really critical way to think about politics as well. And thinking about youth organizations and how young people helped redefine notions of citizenship and political fitness, I think was really rewarding for us as a editorial collective.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And I guess kind of shifting backwards in time now to think about the section on children under the early Cold War. I think something that's very striking is that on both sides of the Iron Curtain, we see political leaders marshaling images of children to prove that their way of life is better, right? I mean, children, I think it's, you know, it's no coincidence that children figure very prominently in Cold War propaganda, and not just within the United States. What had been less explored, and something that we wanted to explore in this section, were the experiences of children themselves, right, who are living through this era, who, you know, are, of course, you know, being told that they need to, you know, help spread democracy around the world, and that the American way of life is better. And so what were their actual experiences like? And we focused on children who were participating in these international friendship programs. So they were writing to pen pals across the globe, and kind of what that experience was like for them. Some of them even traveled overseas in the late 40s to help rebuild bombed out schools in Germany, right? That's kind of a way of, like, you know, building this kind of post-war alliance with a former enemy. And I mean, they had some very experiences that they, you know, wrote home about, hanging out with, like, former Hitler youth, how much fun they were having with them. I mean, just a very, very kind of crazy stories. And, you know, children who are participating, as Susan mentioned, in science fairs, in Boy Scout troops, who are collecting clothing and helping to kind of helping their peers in other parts of the so-called free world build up their Boy Scout troops. And then we even have a chapter looking at home education courses that were being taught in high schools, and the kinds of messages that were being given to young people about how they could adjust their own personalities, how they could kind of transform themselves in order to help bolster American democracy. And this notion of kind of personal transformation as a route to political transformation, to these kind of larger societal changes, this is a theme that we kept on coming back to again and again across the eras on the part of both liberals and conservatives, right? This notion that, you know, through changing oneself, and of course, children are the most malleable, right? So they're often the targets of these kinds of projects, right? That by personal transformation, these kind of larger societal transformations can occur. And what we found, you know, looking at primary sources produced by children, was that these messages were sometimes eagerly adopted by young people, and they were sometimes rejected. And there was sometimes a little bit of both, right? And sometimes children were kind of taking part in these larger political projects, but for different reasons, like not necessarily for political reasons, but because they could gain something from themselves, right? So this very kind of interesting story about children helping to kind of bolster the Cold War order, but also challenge it.
And I really, I mean, again, I thought that this collection and the way that you all approach it is so fascinating to think about, because it is about politics, but it's also about these cultural dimensions that are, you know, often considered soft power. And because we're talking about children, we're not talking about necessarily, you know, treaties between countries, but all of these different ways that young people were integrated into sort of the culture and politics of the day. I did want to ask you before we go much further, because this is a contested term, particularly these days when we talk about it as applied to different racial groups in the United States. And so can you all sort of talk about what you mean by child, children, or youth, as the term is in the title of the book? And how come this term itself seems to be elastic in its application?
I think that I'll start, and I hope you guys will join me there. Youth itself has become kind of a political term. It's adults associate all kinds of characteristics with it: rebellion, or sometimes the opposite, laziness or sort of a kind of complacency, perhaps, to use a better word. And what I found really powerful and unique about the chapters that we delivered is actually we also deconstruct the concept of youth and childhood and the way it's been deployed in politics. And oftentimes we rely on the youth actors themselves to tell us what they mean by how they define their own life, their own embodied experience. And then what we discover is that those terms actually rarely fit or too neatly are restricting. And what we see, in fact, what we tend to do in the work and in the volume is to think about the definition of youth as it's conceived by themselves. And many of the chapters also provide something a lot more critical in the sense that we pay attention to different age groups within youth categories and highlight how that affects perceptions and engagement with politics. Youth demographics tend to be lumped together, and that's also kind of contributed to broader notions about youth, this sort of lumping youth and childhood and youth. And what this volume does is sort of counter that kind of lumping by showing that there's a cost to that because there are age-graded interests and they are formulated in different ways. And we undercut the power of non-age of majority citizenship too if we tend to lump those together.
And of course, I mean, I think there's always this lingering question, who gets a childhood, right? Like who gets to be considered a child? You know, as we see, very sharply nowadays and have also historically, right, like a lot of that has to do with race, right? Youthful innocence is something that, in popular culture and in politics is something that white youth, right, get to embody in a way that youth of color do not.
Yeah, and in my chapter, my contribution to this volume, I talk a lot about white childhood innocence and the notion of endangered childhood and the ways in which that can be kind of employed in order to marginalize groups that have been historically marginalized. And most visibly, that takes place through the growth of the carceral state and other sorts of kind of punitive mechanisms of the state.
And so I did want to ask you, this is one of the questions I get to ask editors of edited volumes that often elicits great input. You all asked colleagues that you knew or maybe you didn't know to contribute chapters as you sort of came up with this schema for the book. And so my question to each of you, since it sounds like you each also had responsibility for one of the sort of historical contextual sections, is what research most surprised you as these chapters were rolling in? And obviously, this is not asking you to define what your favorite chapter is, because they're all favorites. Having edited books myself, I know they are all my favorite chapters. But the question is really, what, as you were reading a chapter, like, wow, I never thought of that. Or that's an amazing sort of understanding of what was going on. So any of you can start with what was most surprising in the research.
Well, I can start us off. We can kind of go chronologically, I guess, through the different chapters of the different sections of the book. So reading Molly Jessup's chapter on life adjustment education was the first time that I had ever come across the term life adjustment education. I don't know if any listeners have heard of it either. But this was a curriculum developed and employed in public schools across the country during the 1950s. So, I mean, and this was extremely popular. And it was basically instruction on kind of how to behave socially. And so there were instructions on how to dress, how to relate to peers. There were kind of questionnaires that students were asked. They were asked to kind of give these questionnaires to peers and have them rate them on their likability, on their looks, on the way that they dress, and all of these things that one now would just think of as kind of superficial characteristics. But this was considered really important. And Molly Jessup found all of these really interesting reports made by life adjustment education teachers that were, sent up to kind of the higher ups in public education reporting on the successes of this program. Not surprisingly, a lot of the material was focused on young women, right? And kind of, I don't want to say policing the behavior of them, right? But kind of really focusing on young women and kind of, how they could be reshaped in this way. And I think, knowing, what we know about gender roles in the 1950s, that's not particularly surprising. But it's just so interesting to kind of see the ways that these messages kind of hit out on the ground, right? Kind of the way that young people were really, kind of indoctrinated into these notions of gender and notions of how they themselves could behave. So that was one of the most kind of interesting and eye-opening pieces of research that I encountered.
And I can build forward and chronologically. That's a very hard question, because I would say I discovered something really special about each of these chapters, not only the ones that I was responsible for as part of the editing team, but I think what resonated with me, and I'll maybe two of the most unique things that, or interesting aspects that I didn't really know much about, I discovered in Annie Wan's chapter, and I brought her up earlier, her work on Asian American youth was really revealing, because again, the power of the model minority myth is so pervasive in American society and continues to be so pervasive. And the fact that these young high schoolers in particular, she identifies the high school as a very important site where young Asian Americans eschewed this external classification as a model minority, the assumption that people of Asian descent had overcome discrimination, achieved economic and educational success. But this is also a very timely topic, because what she really reveals is how many Asian American youth also were profiled, racially profiled by the police, and how, because of the model minority myth, they didn't always have access to the same resources to protect themselves. And so they joined that force to put graphite on, in many ways, those invisible fingerprints of these deep challenges. She also talks about tracking in high schools and how that puts Asian American youth in a particular category and creates divisions within youth communities of color. And what's interesting, that is also the catalyst then for many of these youth to join the third world movements and anti-war movements to restore those divisions that have artificially imposed that were supposed to divide communities of color. I found her chapter particularly revealing because she also really shows just the depth of challenges that Asian American youth encountered, the drug problems, the racial profiling, the criminalization of Asian American youth that is something that we don't often hear about historically, past, present. So that was really a powerful chapter. But again, I learned so much in each of these different chapters about how we conceptualize history, how we think about youth then and today. I think just to add maybe one more bit that is quite useful as a historian to think about conceptual and periodic frameworks. Jennifer Helgren's chapter on the opening of disabled members, but how even as youth organizations attracted and invited youth with disabilities, how those youth were also utilized to restore abled categories that and create new categories within the realm of disabilities. I thought that was really revealing, and it's helpful for us to think about how young people become operationalized and utilized and exploited in popular discourses, but also how they push back on those boundaries and those kinds of categories.
Paul, you get to play cleanup here.
If I had to select one chapter, again, this isn't my favorite chapter or anything like that, but one that maybe surprised me was Amy Sue Bix's chapter in the third section, because it, I think, shed new light on the issue of gender and STEM and girlhood and STEM education. And she demonstrates how in the early Cold War period, this was obviously kind of deemed anathema, or it was unthinkable that girls, young women would want to pursue STEM education or serve as engineers or what have you. And, you know, with the convulsions of the 60s and 70s and beyond, that became actually quite accepted and indeed encouraged. And there's an interesting sort of analytical component to this, or I guess new perspective that she provides, I think, which kind of complicates this general understanding of girls in STEM as good. And that is that it can, in many ways, kind of perpetuate inequality, or maybe open up new forms of inequality, or present new kind of ways to gloss inequality. So I think she, in that chapter and through, you know, a variety of sources, is employing some really interesting kind of political theoretical work that, you know, feminist scholars like Nancy Fraser and others have utilized. But she's applying it in this way. And I found that really refreshing and interesting.
And so I also wanted to ask you, because part of what you've been talking about and part of what I saw as I was reading the book was that there are understandings of, say, the rights revolution period with regard to politicizing lots of different social movements and moving people to the streets and having particularly young people, but perhaps college, I don't know if that's youth or not these days, as, you know, sort of the sharp point of the spear in a lot of that. But a lot of what you're finding and a lot of what your authors are writing about are, to some degree, like, you think this is kind of the case, but maybe it's not. And I sort of found that to be the case in a lot of these chapters, in sort of reconceptualizing what we did think about was going on and how young people were involved in it. Can you talk again about some surprises in terms of, like, conclusions that we all think we know, but in fact are not the case?
Oh, something that I thought was really fascinating, actually, in Sarah's chapter was how adults try to portray a certain image of the United States and how young people became the vessel through their letters to convey that to foreign youth. Something that I was really struck by, and I think sort of by looking at an understudied body of evidence, was to see that foreigners didn't always buy that narrative. They didn't always internalize or receive that message and pushed back and revealed another image about the United States in the process of that discourse and that exchange. And I thought that was really powerful to think that hegemony was in fact not as powerful, and the message wasn't as successful at times. I thought that to me really resonated and tells us something about using certain kinds of sources to change and challenge narratives.
I think there's often the assumption that that young people get out on the streets and march for liberal causes, and that conservative causes are using children primarily as symbols. And I think something that we discovered in putting together these chapters, and I'm thinking of Susan's chapter in particular, is that that is not the case. You know, there are children who are active in various ways on both sides of the political spectrum. I mean, Susan highlights a number of really interesting letters, you know, written by conservative youth, you know, to American leaders, coming out in favor of the American war in Vietnam. You know, this is something that you don't really hear about, right? Young people who are making their opinions know that they're supportive of U.S. actions in Southeast Asia. You know, so I think, you know, kind of breaking down that liberal conservative divide and kind of thinking about like where children fall, you know, it's not as kind of neat a picture as I think many of us would perhaps believe.
Especially at a historical moment when scholars and even popular narratives assign that with a moment of youth rebellion against the war, sort of the height of the anti-war movement, we see that that's simply not true. And maybe to build on that, it's too that it's not just the binaries that we've created or that Americans continue to hold on don't always align. It's also this sense of allegiance between youth categories that becomes dislodged in the process of this larger narrative that we've outlined in this book.
Yeah, and I think there's this conception also, just speaking very broadly, that youth politics kind of, well, the politics of children and young people will remain fixed. And in that sense, you know, demographics are destiny. And people said that about, you know, the youth who were, yes, marching against the Vietnam War in support of African-American civil rights, et cetera. And in many ways, you know, the world that those folks were organizing for really never came to be because many of their kind of exigencies changed. And so I think that was something that we're kind of getting at in the intro when we were talking about many of the movements that we saw around us that were led largely by young people, thinking specifically of the March for Our Lives campaign. And, you know, I think there's a lot of discourse now that, oh, well, the kids will save us. And maybe, but maybe they won't. And so I think that's something that kind of in historical perspective, this book, you know, seeks to maybe trouble.
And I really like that the way that you integrated the discussion of the youth movement now around gun control, because they are experiencing so much of this destructiveness in their schools, as I have two high schoolers myself. And so I really appreciated that, you know, you're bringing in yet again another movement that has been spearheaded by young people. But as you say, it's not necessarily clear what the end result will be.
Yeah. I think one other aspect that I was really struck by is sort of the moral anchor that we assign to adulthood. And in fact, that lies oftentimes, with the youngest. Most recently, as of this week, I think we've been contemplating about the role of youth, especially with Donella Fraser's recording. I think journalists have paid attention a little bit more about what that actually means and the way we think about young people's role too. And I was struck at one of the journalists but talked about her, the sort of the moral core that she exhibited in this moment. And again, what we see when we look at young people and their role, because she did help change something, potentially even the political discourses and the way Americans will proceed following the verdict of Derek Chauvin with police reform. Potentially, we could see this moment as a catalyst. And what I was struck by is by her testimony, where she adds something very powerful in this process, not just that she delivered critical evidence, but she also humanized groups who have been victimized. She reminded the defense and the prosecution that George Floyd was a father. And I think young people's voices are critical in humanizing people. Communities of color are critical in maybe recentering the moral core of the United States. And that goes back to something we brought up earlier about personal responsibility.
And I just wanted to note that we are listening to one of our author's dogs in the background as well. That's just the way the cookie crumbles these days. And I did want to ask the three of you, because this is a really interesting book and certainly one that took some effort to pull together. What is it that each of you separately or together are working on now in terms of your own research?
I'd be happy to start off. I am working on a book manuscript titled Shopping for Empire, American Tourists, Consumption and Power After World War II. And it's a book that looks at the experiences of American tourists abroad in the two decades following World War II. And it looks at their experiences through the lens of shopping and consumption and souvenir hunting.
I'm currently at works on a project tentatively titled Dying Young that looks at the significance of youth death in the course of the 20th century and mourning practices and how those practices also shape policy decisions. It's an early stage of the research, but I look at for familiar cases like Emmett Till, but also unfamiliar cases like Eric Moore's youth who died in Chicago. And so I'm trying to think about broader notions of youth in the context of policymaking, but also the role that youth death plays in that conversation. Much of my research up until this point has focused on youth activism, those central actors, but I thought I wanted to shift to the symbolic nature of youth, especially in the context of death.
I would love to have each of you separately or together. If you do have another volume. Oh, Paul, I think we have unmuted you. So please.
Sorry about that. Yeah. Yeah. So my next book project is going to focus on Ryan White and the politics of childhood and AIDS and sexuality in the 80s. And I recently signed an advanced contract with UNC Press. So I'm very much looking forward to writing that. Now I have to actually do it. But yeah, no, it's a really interesting story, and I hope to provide new perspective on it.
Thank you. And I would love to talk to each of you separately about these when they are out. And I know, as I said, I'm a political scientist, you're historians, but these are all incredibly topical and political issues. So I hope that you will join me back on the New Books in Political Science podcast to talk about your work. Today, I've been joined by Susan Eckelman-Bergel, Sarah Fieldston, and Paul Renfro to talk about their really fascinating book, Growing Up America, Youth and Politics Since 1945, published by the University of Georgia Press in 2019. I assume one can buy this book at the University of Georgia Press website. Is there a favorite brick and mortar store that any of you have that has a great online presence where one can buy the book?
I've started purchasing books via book what's it called?
Bookshop.
It also generates revenue for independent bookstores.
That's great. Paul?
Yeah, Midtown Reader in Tallahassee is a good one, a nice local bookshop.
All right. And thanks to the three of you for joining me today to talk about this really fascinating book. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Sure.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.